Welcome to episode 9 of the Serious About Security podcast for Friday, June 8th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or Sirius, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the hosts of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at Sirius.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP.
We have no announcements this week, so we're going to skip right to the news. We have two news items. The first is that Microsoft released an out-of-band update on June 3rd in order to revoke three of their certificates. One of these certificates was a forged certificate that was used by the Flame malware. We will talk about that in our articles today. And Mozilla, Firefox, and Thunderbird were updated to release 13, which corrected 7 vulnerabilities, 4 of them critical, and 5 of them high. And that happened on June 5th. And that's it for the news.
So I'll begin the articles for today. This was the week of password leaks. Three major sites announced that they had password hashes that were leaked. This included LinkedIn, which reported 6.5 million passwords, eHarmony, which I believe was around 1.5 million, and most recently Last.fm. And in the case of LinkedIn, these password hashes were found to be unsalted as well. And there's actually a link that you can visit at lastpass.com/LinkedIn, where you can check to see if your password was one of the ones that was compromised. So we thought this would be an interesting one to kind of start the discussion off this week on. Looking at the scenario with LinkedIn, what I find probably most alarming is the fact that the passwords were unsalted. Not so much that they were made available. It seems like this has happened to other sites, but the fact that a salt wasn't applied in this case makes it relatively easy to determine the plain text on some of the easier passwords, which means that users who have that same username and password combination on other sites could be vulnerable for those sites as well. So it's a good example of why it's really important to use different passwords for different sites to kind of help prevent this type of scenario from getting at you. You know, the one thing I would recommend is if you've got an account on LinkedIn, it would not hurt to change your password immediately, but also just be very careful about if you've used that username and password combination anywhere else. I think it'd be really vital to kind of go in and go ahead and change that password and, you know, make it a strong password if it's not one already. So what are your guys' thoughts about kind of this interesting week? I know last time we were talking about there wasn't a lot going on, and this week we've got all these interesting articles and these passwords being leaked by these major providers. Is kind of interesting that all the three reported on the same week within a couple of days of each other.
I think it's interesting that that these fairly well-known organizations are suffering such security problems. And we talk all the time, you know, as security professionals about, you know, just the bare minimum best practices that every organization should take part in and implement within their organization. But these are web-based organizations. There's not these guys don't operate a brick and mortar. They are online. And so there's an even higher standard that we hold organizations like this, especially LinkedIn being a publicly traded company now, that these organizations haven't done. They haven't taken the basic steps here. And one of those is, besides monitoring your systems and you know, creating your security architecture in a way that prevents this attack, but also being able to detect when things happen, they weren't even salting passwords. And we should probably back up and talk about what a password salt is. And that's just a way of adding some level of complexity to the encoded part of the password that you'd actually store in the database. You don't want to store the plain text password because then your administrators would have access to it. Or if somebody compromised your database, they would be able to actually see all of the passwords. So you encode them in some way, transform them into a different representation. But on top of that, having the same representation for somebody or for two users that have typed the exact same password, representation would show up in the database as well, and you could then identify users that have the exact same password. So a salt is a way of adding permutations to the same password so that when you store them in the database in their encoded form, they don't actually match up, even though the users may have picked the exact same password. Where this comes into play here is, and I think I saw a statement online earlier, is that salting a password is not just a best practice. It should be common practice. To not do that is uncommon. At least we would hope it would be, especially from an organization such as LinkedIn with the large number of users that they do have. I mean, they have they need to do some due diligence here in protecting user information, and clearly they haven't done that. Now, on the flip side, going back to a few episodes ago, we talked about password tools and the ability to create unique, long, and highly random passwords for each of these online services and then being able to manage those with a password tool. This is a great example of where this came into play because for me, when I found out that LinkedIn had compromised passwords out there on the net, it was merely a matter of for me to go to the LinkedIn site and go and generate another highly complex, long, and store that password. It was not a big deal for me to go and correct this issue, other than the time it took to do it, which was very short. For other users who don't follow these standards, don't have password tools, I'm sure they were sitting down thinking, well, my password of red car is not going to work now, so I need to pick another one. So let's go with blue truck. I don't think that's going to be the right approach here, sadly, but I think a lot of users, when they hear change their password and they have a limited memory space for the amount of passwords they already have, they're going to pick one they already have, which is not best practice, certainly, or they're going to modify the one they already have used in LinkedIn. So I think it's kind of a sad day for both users and for companies like this in terms of password security. Of course, we'd love to get rid of passwords, but we probably never will, sadly.
Well, I think this goes to show that, you know, you need to be constantly keeping up to date with the latest trends. I don't know when LinkedIn was developed, but perhaps it was developed at a time when salting passwords wasn't the standard. I'm not saying that it was, but even if it was, they should have, you know, kept up with the latest technologies and security standards. LinkedIn has stated that now, if you change your password, it'll be salted. So, so even if you're not on that list, you should probably change your password so that it does get, you know, further secured. But I don't think there's really much of an excuse for a company like LinkedIn that to not salt their passwords. I mean, it's one of those steps in security that you can do to make things a lot more difficult. I mean, salting and just hashing it over, you know, hundreds of times during the hashing process and things like that can just make the security of your hashed passwords just that much better.
So you did mention you're not sure how long ago LinkedIn was. So I pulled it up just to see. And they were founded in 2003. Founded in 2002, launched in 2003. The interesting thing I also noted is they state they have 161 million users. They lost 6.5 million passwords, but they have 161 million users. And I think that's certainly a higher number than I ever thought. Now I'm wondering if they've hired the right people to run this organization from a product and marketing perspective. That's great, but then the question becomes, did they hire any security people to work for them as well? And they have 2,400 employees. I would hope they would have a couple dedicated to watching for these issues, but perhaps they invested in other areas, let's say.
Well, yeah, and one thing I've noticed, since we have an array of companies that suffered this fate this week, is, as I mentioned earlier, eHarmony also had their passwords leaked. But what I noticed in looking at their response is they forced the users that they felt were compromised to immediately have to change their password upon login. I'm not saying LinkedIn didn't do that, but I didn't read anything along the lines that they would do that. When I logged in, I certainly wasn't forced to change my password. I think some of this, as you were mentioning, Keith, is the security stance. Like I said, it boggles my mind that the passwords weren't salted in the first place. But also, you know, in responding, I'm not sure they've encountered these kind of things. So, you know, I think if anything good comes out of these password leaks is everyone, the large companies like LinkedIn and the end users, kind of get an appreciation for how these things can really happen. Because I feel like a lot of times when we're doing these podcasts, we're saying, hypothetically, if you use the same password for every site, if those passwords ever became known, you would be at great risk. Well, here's a great example. I mean, what did you mention? Over 100 million users use LinkedIn. So now 6.5 million hashes were reported. But I have to wonder how many users does that represent? Because I'm assuming all those are unique, it may represent a much larger base of users than 6.5 million users. So, I mean, the scope of this is pretty large, and it's a real example of how these things can happen. And you know, if anything makes me a little nervous is I look at an organization like LinkedIn thinking they must be doing things right. You know, 2,400 employees, they probably have a big security team. They probably have these folks in place. It's the smaller sites. It's the ones you don't know too much about, the small shops where it's one or two people running it. You know, what's their security stance? I think it's a great opportunity for everyone involved to kind of step back and say, if it can happen to LinkedIn, chances are it can happen to you if you're a small shop and you're doing something similar. So, you know, I think it's a great time to evaluate your security policies. You know, if you're storing the passwords plain text, at least begin hashing them. I will say that in their defense, at least they weren't plain text. It wasn't like they got them plain text. So they at least taken that step. But in addition, you know, you should salt it, hopefully with some complexity in that whole process so that it's not easy to ever reverse engineer it in the event that the passwords ever do get leaked, which is the one part of the story I've not heard from any of them is actually how the passwords were leaked. I'd be very interested to know how those passwords were obtained.
I think you'll find that in the case of LinkedIn, and the more I read about the less happy I am. But in the case of LinkedIn, they did not report that they lost passwords. It was reported to somewhere that there was a site, you know, like a paste bin type site that had their hashes from their accounts. And then it was a news story. And then the news reporters went to go and ask LinkedIn and they said, I don't know, we'll look into it. And there's a blog post, if I remember correctly, indicating they were investigating. But if you go to the LinkedIn site page right now, you will find no mention of this. And when I logged in to change my password, I was not prompted to change my password. I just did it because it needed to be done. Now, I would ask if you try to log in now, does it say, oh, by the way, you really ought to change that password? I suspect it does not. And if they're not telling you on their main page that you should change your password and they're not forcing you to change your password, then I think that's an issue. Because if there are 6.5 million hashes out there, what about the other 150 some odd passwords, 150 million passwords that are part of somebody's account but maybe not listed there? So then the other thing I'll mention, eHarmony site. Again, I went to look at their site. No mention of this issue. Now they may be forcing people to change. I don't know. I do not have an account with them. I do have an issue with one of their things. It says eHarmony is the number one trusted online dating site for singles. I think they can take that trusted part out because I don't think they deserve that title anymore. Last.fm, same thing. There's no mention of this. Again, I don't have an account with them, so I would not be able to easily check unless I registered real quick. But even then, probably wouldn't get a notice. So I don't know. Obviously, this is a PR issue for these guys. But they certainly have not come out and said, oh, yeah, we made a mistake, and we're going to fix it. They've said nothing, which is worse. I will now discontinue my rant on this issue.
Well, one more point along those lines as well that I found very interesting. As I mentioned earlier, LastPass has a link where you can try the LinkedIn password. So the very first one I tried, of course, was password, because that's such a fun one. And of course, it was in there. But it also kind of gets me thinking along the lines, as bad as it was they weren't salting their passwords, they obviously didn't have a very strict password policy associated with the site also. And I'm looking at a blog entry from eHarmony talking about their stance on the compromise. And they're saying they recommend members to have a strong password of at least 8 characters composed of lowercase and uppercase numbers and symbols. Recommend tells me it's optional. And in my world, something optional just never gets done. If it, you know, if 6 characters is the bare minimum and it requires no case sensitivity, you're going to be assured someone's going to have a 6-character password in the system. So, you know, I think part of taking a security stance here as well is kind of forcing users' hands to say, oh, by the way, when you go in to log in, when you go into LinkedIn or eHarmony to change that password, we're not going to make you. It's going to force you to make it a strong password. We're going to help protect you in this case. And I know everyone's like, well, I don't like the strong passwords. But if every site enforced those rules, everyone would have to get used to it. And it would at least add a little more protection in this case. So that was another thing that I found a bit alarming is the type of passwords that were in the compromise as well, that there's really no, you know, we're talking basic dictionary words where in the event of a rainbow table, it's very, very easy to find.
And the other issue, going back to harp on LinkedIn some more, they're not catching these simple passwords when people use them. Now, obviously, they don't want to inconvenience some people because that would drive away customers. I understand that. I really do. But I think it's there's some amount of responsibility that a company should take when it says, that password you want to use, that's not a good one. You might want to try something a little more difficult. Or maybe they should do a deal with one of these password management companies and say, that password is really bad. In fact, I bet you use that password in multiple sites. Here's a thought. Why don't you download this tool, try it for 30 days for free, and use it with our site? Now, I don't know why 1Password, LastPass, KeePass aren't scrambling for opportunities like that. That seems like a big marketing boon here. If you guys, anyways, I'll take my marketing hat off now. The one site I will recommend people to go check out if they've not done that is shouldichangemypassword.com. They keep track of these various things that get posted periodically if accounts get compromised, and it will tell you if your email or your account was part of some of those compromised accounts. And we've looked at it before. I don't know if we talked about it on the podcast. I've certainly talked about it to other folks when these things have happened in the past. So it's something good that you might want to look into if you're curious about where else your account might be compromised.
Well, I was just looking at LastPass, and apparently they, with their recent version change, they added the security challenge feature where it would essentially on your local machine, essentially look at all your passwords and compare them with commonly used passwords or compromised passwords, and it would check to see which sites you use the same password on, and alert you to that, and kind of give you a security score at the end. So I haven't used that feature myself, but it sounds like an interesting feature, and I may use it after we're done with this podcast.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the take-home message from all of this is that all of, you know, everyone should go back, look at the sites they use, make sure you're using strong passwords, use one of the tools. We've mentioned several here already, 1Password, LastPass, I like PasswordSafe, and make sure all your passwords are unique with that. And honestly, when you use a tool such as that, as Keith explained earlier, when these types of things happen, you know, you just have to go to one site, change it, and you know, you're in good shape. And I'm going to challenge Keith here a little bit. I think that his password that he had previously on LinkedIn probably would have been very hard to break anyway, because I doubt it was my red car or something. I think it was probably along the lines of several numbers, digits, symbols, uppercase, lowercase, and probably really long. So even though it's in that hash that's been that's out there that people can try, I think the time to break it would be far greater than worth the effort. And by the time they broke it, Keith has probably already changed that password 8 to 10, 20 additional times, or his great-grandkids have adult children at that point, because it would probably be many, many years.
Probably so. But given the multiple issues we found with LinkedIn and their inability to hold on to passwords, I wonder what other problems they have. So just as a precaution, I should point out, I changed it from a 20-character password to a 25-character password, because that's the new default since I changed it last for me. So.
That should be strong enough for now, I'd imagine.
I think for the next, at least until the end of the universe, I should be okay.
Until the end of the universe, it is.
Okay, well, we'll move on to the next one then. This was my article. This one is on the Flame malware and how Microsoft kind of gave some details about exactly what happened. Basically, what Microsoft has said is that somebody was able to forge a certificate that they issued using an MD5 collision attack, which is basically they were able to generate a different certificate with that resulted in the same MD5 hash, which basically meant it was accepted by when the certificate was checked. And they were able to essentially attach all the chains onto that newly generated certificate, and it was considered valid. And this was used by the Flame malware, which essentially was a malware that was able to install as a Microsoft Windows update using this forged certificate. And I think there's a few interesting things about this article. One is that I'm not sure if this was had ever been done before, that MD5 collision was used to generate a certificate to basically do a Windows update. And the other interesting thing about it is that they didn't use a Windows update certificate to do this. They used a different certificate, and Windows update basically is willing to accept any valid Microsoft certificate for a Windows update. Microsoft has said they're going to separate their certificates and have a specific certificate for Windows updates, and I guess they won't accept any valid Microsoft certificate when installing Windows updates. You have to have the Windows update specific certificate. But I found this article interesting because Microsoft did release an out-of-band update within a few weeks of Patch Tuesday, which is unusual for them. So they thought this was a very critical fix, and they revoked three of their certificates. I'm guessing, I didn't actually look into it, but I'm guessing the three certificates they revoked were all used MD5 as the hash for the certificate, which I checked all the certificates that I use in all of our websites, and we don't have MD5 on any of them. And I'm not sure how long the standard has not been to use MD5 for certificate hashing, but we don't use them on our certificates. So I thought that article was interesting. What do you think about it?
Well, your point about the MD5, I was just looking through the article, and they say that back in 2004, Chinese researchers showed how to create colliding MD5 messages at that time, and it took about an hour in 2004 to technology. So by 2012, I imagine it's down to what, minutes? I don't know, seconds. But yeah, the possibility at least has existed as far back as 2004. So it shouldn't have been a surprise that some point this would occur. But, you know, the scope of this is really what I find to be pretty astonishing. I mean, you can see Microsoft reacted quickly, and I applaud their effort to react quickly, because the ability for malware to get installed on your computer as part of your regular security update, that's a really, I think someone used the phrase, that's a nightmare scenario for security engineers, because what do we tell everyone? Keep your machine patched, keep it up to date. Well, if malware could get distributed through that mechanism, you know, basically it would spread to everyone who thinks they're doing best practices. So, you know, I do commend Microsoft for doing an out-of-band patch to try to prevent this from spreading or becoming worse than it is.
I think the bigger issue here is that this attack method used a chosen prefix collision attack variant that had previously not been known. So we're talking a class of cryptanalysis that was done to develop this malware that we have not seen before. And while attacking an update mechanism is considered, I think as the quote in the article was, the holy grail of malware writers, the fact that they figured out a new way to do cryptanalysis in order to exploit not a problem per se with the update system, but an old way of doing certificates using a hashing mechanism that has a flaw. Who does that? It's not your guy in the basement working on his computer, okay? It's probably not a group of guys in their basement working on computers writing this stuff. I'm going to go out on a limb, and we'll talk about this in the next article set, and I'm going to say that Flame is another example of a nation state developing malware. We have no confirmation of that, but I think the level of sophistication here is points in a way that says this is another example of a nation state developing malware. Now, the exact purpose of this one may be a little less clear, as Stuxnet was a little more obvious. But the fact is that these aren't just guys in the basement writing this stuff anymore. These are guys sitting in a top secret facility somewhere on a government campus somewhere writing this stuff now. So then the bigger question becomes, in my mind, is this what we would call a cyber weapon? And have we reached the point where now we have to worry about the proliferation of these weaponry, if you will, in a way that they have no physical limitation? Now, when we're talking nuclear weapons, there's a physical element too. You have to get the bomb to the target, and it has to actually explode. And then there's a contained, or not contained, but an area that is affected by that. Now we have cyber weapons that have no physical presence. And how do we contain them, let alone how do we control who has them and who develops them? At least when I'm developing a nuclear weapon, I got to have uranium. I have to go mine uranium. I have to refine it. I have to put it through a centrifuge. I have to do all these physical steps in order to develop a nuclear weapon. I mean, we're talking about Iran right now trying to develop nuclear weapons, and look at what they've invested in doing that. And we know what they're doing. But who knows who's developing cyber weapons? And it's not just a nation state. It could be an organized criminal element who has brought together the right sorts of people and said, hey, let's go and write some stuff that attacks financial institutions, for example, because I need to put money in my bank account. So now we're not just worried about the guy in his basement building a nuclear reactor. Those guys we catch easily because they have physical presence. They need physical goods. Now we're talking about cyber weapons. It can be developed on a laptop that's not even connected to the internet and then suddenly released. And then we're out of control here. So while I find Flame interesting in the way that it gets around, I think what's more interesting is who wrote it. And the question is, who wrote it? I'd like to know. Stuxnet, we kind of figured out. Flame, maybe it's the same group. We don't know. That remains to be seen. But we did, if you recall, a few podcasts previously talk about Stuxnet and some reporting that was done in 60 Minutes, which kind of nobody came out and said the U.S. did it, but it was all kind of leaning in that direction. And this week we find out that they actually did do that. So, but anyways, we were talking about Flame. We'll talk about Stuxnet next. Is there anything else you wanted to add to this discussion?
Well, I wanted to mention comment on something you mentioned. I think there was actually some security vulnerabilities that were exploited in this. I mean, maybe not what we would consider traditional security vulnerabilities, but the fact that Microsoft was accepting any certificate for Windows updates, I think, was a security vulnerability. It's not, well, I don't think what we would necessarily call a traditional one, but I mean, Microsoft kind of pointed out, and they said they were going to change that behavior from then on, and I think that was an example. Their Windows Update certificate, I think, was fine. It had the standard SHA-1, SHA-256 hashes. I'm guessing they didn't revoke that certificate, but they were accepting any Microsoft signed thing, even old certificates that hadn't been revoked and were still valid, which I think was the problem. If they would have not done that, then this wouldn't have been possible through this method.
Yes, but while I'll agree with that, the traditional model in a digital certificate world is that, can I trust the chain to a root anchor of trust? And so they're now going to shrink that anchor of trust down to just being updates. But in the certificate model, we don't think that way. We think about the intermediate CAs, and we talk about the CA at the top, and any certificate issued under there should be trusted. Okay, so it's not uncommon for an organization to configure a CA at the top and create intermediate CAs underneath, and then use those to issue certificates for different purposes. And any one of those would be accepted as being a valid certificate, because that's how we've always done it. So while this is actually a case where Microsoft followed the traditional best practice of creating a CA and intermediate CAs and writing the right certificates. And the problem was they used MD5. Sure, that's a problem. Hopefully they'll replace those. But in the traditional mindset of a security model, as long as I can go back and check every chain in that certificate chain of trust all the way back to the root CA, then hey, we're good. That's the way we've always done it. So now we have to rethink about that. You know, is this the right method? Microsoft is saying, well, let's contain that root a little bit more. And so to prevent this from happening, and certainly that's a good idea, but I can't fault them for that way of doing it, because that's the standard security model for a CA.
All right, well, we'll move on to the next article then. Keith is going to talk about some Stuxnet stuff.
Yeah, so I kind of already alluded to this. We had a podcast episode, which I want to say it was episode 4, but I'm probably not correct on that, in which we talked about Stuxnet and talked about a 60 Minutes episode, which had General Michael Hayden come on and say that this was a great idea. We should be doing this more, but never owned up to the fact that he actually oversaw this program during his running of the NSA. So actually, I'm not sure if he was at NSA at the time, but he was CIA director as well. So anyways, but he, I'm sure, had great knowledge of this. So after some reporting by David Sanger of the New York Times on June 1st, they published an article talking about how the president had ordered cyber attacks against Iran. This was a program started under the Bush administration and continued under the Obama administration. And the idea was to program some malware that would specifically target Iran's Natanz plant, in which they use centrifuges to refine uranium down to down for use in nuclear reactors and possibly weapons. And so they created a thing called Stuxnet, and delivered it to the plant, we believe, through a double agent who possibly used a USB flash drive to actually deliver the malware onto these devices, or at least put it onto the network within the plant. And so these things targeted a particular programmable logic controller, which was used in an array of centrifuges. And it basically altered the speed of the centrifuges in a way that they physically destroyed themselves. And then lied, basically, about information sent back to the control center. So they would appear that the units were running correctly, but they could actually go down to where the centrifuges were and find just pieces of centrifuge everywhere, because these things would self-destruct if they ran too fast. And this was actually, turns out, this was actually tested by the U.S. government, who had acquired the very same centrifuges from Libya, who gave up their nuclear weapon program and turned over their devices to somebody. I don't recall who, but the U.S. ended up with a few of them and actually ran Stuxnet as a test to see if these devices would be destroyed. And it turns out, oh yeah, that works. So that was very interesting. And the other issue was that about halfway through this program or so, after they released several versions, which they were iterating on, you know, like any good agile programming process, they were making improvements over time, right? It turns out they made a goof, and suddenly Stuxnet escaped from where it was supposed to be contained. Apparently it did not check various things to see if it was actually running within the Natanz plant. It could be that an engineer had a laptop, it was doing diagnostics, the Stuxnet got onto his laptop, and then he took that out of the plant, connected it up to the internet, and it spread from there. The interesting thing here is that the president was aware of this. The CIA, the NSA became aware of the fact that this had escaped from the plant. And then the question became, well, do we shut it down or do we continue? And apparently the president decided that they would go ahead and continue the program and, oh, by the way, issue a couple more updates to this thing. And so their double agent apparently snuck in a couple more versions of this thing. But by then it was too late. We now had this Stuxnet that was infecting a variety of computers. Various security companies who track these sorts of things were involved in terms of analyzing them, and that's how we became aware of this, and that's how it became published. So I think, again, for the longest time, the U.S. government would not confirm or deny the fact that this was that had originated in the U.S. and actually had been assisted with the Israelis. So it's a little concerning to me that this is an example that we created a cyber weapon and it got out of control. It actually went beyond the boundaries in which it was supposed to operate. And so this is when I talk about this physical element of a kinetic weapon, if you will. You have to move the weapon to the location in which you want to use it. It's got a physical presence. It's got parts that you have to put together. They're easily detected, or at least hopefully easily detected. Creating these things is not exactly simple. But in the cyber weapon world, they are relatively easy to create. How many people in the U.S. government knew about it? How many people were involved in its creation? Probably a very small group of very smart people. But they're not out there machining uranium and you know, putting it together into a bomb casing or anything like that. There are a couple guys maybe sitting in the basement of the NSA working on this thing. So the problem is we've got a small amount of people that are very smart that can create these weapons, whether they work for a nation state, they work for the U.S., they work for the bad guys, they work for organized crime. It doesn't matter. The fact is anybody can almost create these things with the right group of people smart enough to do it. But the problem is then once what happens when they're released? Stuxnet was designed to contain itself within the Natanz plant. It didn't do that. It didn't do much damage outside of that. Obviously, it's still looking for programmable logic controllers and a certain uranium centrifuge before it would do anything. But the fact is it escaped. we now know about it. Flame, another example. It's out there, and it's taking advantages of security weaknesses in operating systems, and this is all being driven by various governments as a way of saying this is another battlefield for us. Unfortunately, this battlefield also, in the case of the United States, you know, 95% of our physical infrastructure is not owned by the U.S. government. So when we talk about the battlefield being part of the U.S., that affects us directly on a day-to-day basis. We get water and power and all our utilities from this physical infrastructure that is not under control by the United States government. And yet we're launching weapons attacking somebody else's infrastructure. We can only expect retaliatory type attacks. And we're the ones that are going to lose when this happens. And I don't think the U.S. government has thought this through.
Well, one thing I'll comment on, first off, was I found that podcast that you mentioned, and that was from March 5th. It was episode 2, actually, where we initially talked about Stuxnet for the article. So for anyone who wants to look that up, that is episode 2 from March 5th. Just kind of reading through how events unfolded, and I'm referencing the New York Times article at this point, you know, it's interesting how this got started. You know, under the Bush administration, they felt that they needed to be able to do something, and they contemplated physical attacks, but felt the risk was too high, that they couldn't – maybe it would just inflame a situation that was already tense. So they made the decision, and as far as I know, this is the first documented case of the United States' decision to say, well, we'll create a cyber weapon in this case. Obviously, the intent was to do very much like what a physical attack would do, you know, and, you know, it succeeded on being able to slow them down. So, you know, it had all these elements. What I find interesting is when President Obama came in and it was discovered that, you know, people were aware of it, and he, you know, basically said, hey, what should we do? Should we shut this program down or should we continue? And everyone, you know, I think everyone kind of agreed that they felt they should continue. There would be success in continuing. There would still be an advantage in continuing at that point, even though, like you said, it had kind of escaped out of the confine. It was out in the wild now, and people were starting to ask about it. What is this thing? What's going on? There's obviously a lot of people behind it. What, you know, what's going on with that? Oh, and according to this article, one of the things President Obama one of the reasons he was a little reluctant, at least, or he expressed concern that American acknowledgement of cyber weapons could enable the other countries' terrorist hackers to justify their own attacks. And to me, that's, as you said, that's the biggest concern here. Is, you know, I'm sort of intrigued as to why. You know, we've talked about Stuxnet, and we even talked about it back in March, how we thought the United States was involved. But I'm kind of trying to decipher what the intent was at this point to say, yeah, we were part of that. You know, take some credit and say, yeah, we were in on that. Because I guess that's my fear, is the retaliation. By owning up to it, I think, you know, if I'm a terror, you know, if I'm another country outside the United States, it's not friendly with the United States. I'm like, well, they, you know, they struck first. Even, you know, they made it clear that this type of attack is okay. If they're gonna play dirty, I'm gonna play dirty. You know, now I'm not saying that these things probably aren't already happening, but the fact that the United States has admitted to, you know, using this cyber weapon, I don't see why any other country, if they used a cyber weapon against us, you know, the United States, how we can really say, well, that's not fair. Why did you do that to us? You know, if we're using cyber weapons out there as well. And, you know, the other thing I have to wonder about as well is how many, you know, is this just an isolated case? There's a part of me that finds it really hard to believe that this is probably just an isolated case. To me, this is the one. This is the one where, due to whatever reason, an error in the code or a condition that wasn't perceived to happen happened. It escaped that isolated incident and it became recognized. I mean, if it hadn't gotten out back when it did, we still wouldn't be aware of it. There could be other operations like Stuxnet running today that we're totally unaware of, and who knows what they're doing, And then if you think on a bigger scale, it's like, boy, are there things like that running in our country from other countries, from hostile countries from us, that are running on our infrastructure as well. So, I think we're really kind of moving into a new era with these cyber weapons. So it's going to be very interesting to see how things proceed. I mean, the one thing I've not seen a lot yet is a lot of outrage. I haven't necessarily seen a lot of outrage in the fact that a cyber weapon was used. I haven't seen a lot of people kind of standing up saying, well, this is outrageous. How could you do this kind of thing? But I imagine that over time, these things are just going to become more commonplace. I mean, I'm fairly certain of it just based on how things are going. Just because of the, like you said, you don't have those physical boundaries, which is a great advantage and a great disadvantage.
Well, one other thing that I find interesting is how quickly this is essentially public knowledge. I mean, the U.S. has been notorious at just denying things. I mean, they're even in the face of overwhelming evidence, the U.S. will deny things. No, we didn't do that or whatever. And I find it interesting that this is public so quickly. I mean, typically we don't, it's 40 years down the line before we, find out, oh, well, actually, we actually did do this. We've been denying it for all these years, but here we go. Here's the information on it. But in this case, it was 4 years or so, and it's public now. I just find it, amazing that they're willing to be public about this sort of thing so quickly.
Well, I don't know that they're being public about it. I think the article cites a lot of unnamed sources, and so I'm not sure that they are being public. The information has leaked out, let's say. But going back to what Mike said earlier about this being the first case, it's not really the first case. A very good example of this is during the Cold War, in which the Soviets were attempting to buy equipment for the Trans-Siberian Pipeline. And they attempted to purchase some of this equipment from a Canadian firm or something like that. I don't remember the exact details, but they needed some software to run the SCADA systems that control the pipeline valves. And so the CIA happened to intercept that and write some non-standard code. So in that it would operate the way it would normally in a plant and the test would succeed. But after a certain period of time, they begin to do haywire things like opening and closing valves. And anyways, by doing this, they created a very large explosion, the Trans-Siberian pipeline system, so large that it had been the largest fire ever to be, noticed from space, because the early warning satellites that are used to detect missile launches were actually triggering, saying, hey, there's a missile launch down there, when there wasn't actually one. And we didn't find out about that one. This occurred in 1982. We didn't find out about it until 2004. So this is another case, we have the advantage internet in this case, being able to detect remnants, if you will, of the Natanz plant attack. In this case, there wouldn't have been any evidence of it. In fact, the Soviets didn't know what happened. they pretty much claimed that it was a flaw in the plan or faulty equipment or something like that that caused this particular damaging destruction of their own infrastructure. And it took until 2004 before anybody had documented that publicly. So, yeah, you're probably right. There's probably a lot of stuff going on that we will never know about. That's just the nature of the U.S. government, it seems. There's a lot of stuff we don't know about that goes on. But I think that what'll be interesting is not the attacks that we launch. It'll be the retaliatory attacks that are launched against us.
Okay, well, we'll wrap it up now. I wanted to thank the hosts, Keith Watson and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.